Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. This is Healthy Gut Girl coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine. And this is stuff your doctor should know. And I have a brand new microphone. Actually, it's not brand new. Does it sound good? Does my voice sound delicious? I actually have had this blue ball. Actually, it's called a snowball. But for some reason on my settings, it's called a blue ball. That's weird, right? Anyway, I've had this microphone. It was one of the first microphones I purchased back in the day when Mark Lobato was my partner in crime here on the show, who we miss very much, who I just talked to. And he tried to convince me not to use this microphone because he said it's multi-directional and I want a more specific microphone, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's what he gets for abandoning me as a partner. We do see in the foreseeable future partnering up again. Maybe not full time, but just have him on the show once in a while. Anyway, I've had this mic for a long time. Then I thought I was super fancy and getting all these followers, and I figured I'd invest in a mixer and the whole enchilada. And had like the headset, you know, like the helicopter headset where you have like the little mic attached to the headphones, and just started getting these crazy EMF headaches. It would hurt my limbic points on my brain. And then, so got rid of those, sold those, and then went back to regular headphones, like Apple headphones. And I know those of you who are really into this stuff are like, yeah, I know, like I noticed that you have been changing your sound quality and production level value. Anyway, now I went back to this old guy and I got this fancy little mic stand for it and a little foam ball cover. And I don't know, I think it sounds pretty awesome. But today I am thrilled to have yet again another Constantine recommendation. He turned me on to hang on, I gotta get this in front of my face so I can see her, how to say her last name. Andra Sitoyanu. I should have asked her how to say her name, darn it. I hope I didn't butcher that, but she's got a beautiful name and she's beautiful. And he turned me on to her because she is in that circle of pro-metabolic people. And then she joined the estrogen dominance support group on Facebook. If you haven't joined, you, my friend, are out of the game. Everyone is joining the group and it's so much fun. And, you know, I try to make it as chill as possible. And I think I do a pretty good job, but so much wonderful information. And now we have these heavy hitting practitioners who, you know, do flybys and they fly by and they drop some golden nuggets on us and we're able to utilize that information. And she's so awesome. This hour was power packed. She talks so well. She's so well spoken. She does talk fast. But man, is she filled with so much wisdom. Let me tell you a little bit about her. She's a naturopath and a holistic nutritionist out of Montreal, Quebec. She embarked on this journey 5 years ago after the birth of her son, who was diagnosed with a severe case of eczema and developed over dozens of food and environmental allergies. This path led her towards functional medicine and naturopathic principles, honoring the body's innate intelligence and its ability to restore, regenerate, and correct itself when supported. She now focuses on cultivating homeostasis and vitality for her clients by addressing environmental stressors and hormone imbalances, as well as bringing awareness towards tools like bio-individualized nutrition, ooh, I like the sound of that, naturopathic principles, and functional testing. So, guys, this might be one of the most, I mean, look, I know I say that a lot, but it might be one of the most thorough, comprehensive interviews in this nice short hour, filled with so much applicable information. So definitely you're going to want to listen to this one a couple of times. And you're also going to want to follow her on social media. So I will leave that information on the back end and in the show notes. Enjoy. So, I've kind of been in the gut health world for like 17 years now, and then it turned into my own hormonal imbalances and my own hormone issues where I couldn't rectify them without addressing what ultimately ended up being my thyroid. But I didn't know this. All my mentors would say, thyroid is like, as long as your gut is in order, you're going to upregulate thyroid function and it's going to be fine. Well, that's just definitely not the case. I mean, we know gut's super important for thyroid function, but it's not, it's like, we need to address the thyroid, right? So I had all these issues and I started this estrogen dominant support group that you so graciously are part of now for 7 years now. And this podcast along with it, all because of my gut health issues, not resolving everything, right? Not fixing my gut didn't resolve everything. And so Constantine came along quite recently, maybe almost a year now, just by random facts that we had in common and we followed each other as wonderful internet works. And he turned me on to Georgie and you and Danny Roddy and everybody. And it's changed not just my life, but the lives of the women in the group who are hanging on to not everything I say, but as much information as I can bring to them to help them in their situation. So my first question to you is, one of the biggest things that we all combat that's just so prevalent is histamine and allergies. And why is this happening? Well, I know it's a huge question, but like the estrogen connection here, can you start talking about that?
Yes, of course. Well, that actually is a big connection for me because my own son has a lot of histamine issues and a lot of food allergies. He has over 7-8 of the top 10 food allergies.
How old is he?
He's 4 years old.
Oh, wow.
So he started having them when he was about 4 months old. Out of nowhere, or not. The eczema started happening, histamine reactions. He was reacting to everything from, if it wasn't wood or natural fibers like cotton, he would completely react to it. His skin, his mouth. Anyways, the whole body was completely inflamed, mast cell activation. And we do know that there's a huge role playing in there with just hormonal in general. In the root cause, there might be some hormonal issues here. And that kind of potentially started for him even further, right? And that probably started with me. And this is where, you know, I kind of looked at histamine as potentially a trigger in kids these days, but even in women in general, from even decades beforehand, right? And I probably allocate the histamine reactions that he potentially had and some of these food allergies that were, yes, they were epigenetic. And from his term, there was something that definitely happened there, but I did have a play role here. And I do believe that, you know, the birth control pill that I was put on for probably a decade of my life, because my cramps and just my period, my PMS were so debilitating when I was a teenager that they just completely put me on and nobody asked any questions. Of course, you know, my parents thought they were doing the best and it did help me, you know, have a lifestyle that was okay with a quality where, you know, I was able to perform and work and think, but that definitely did play a role in it. Right. So we do know that some of these hormones are, well, billions of them are actually found in the bloodstream, right?
Billions.
Well, yes, the bloodstream is full of hormones, right? Mm. And that the umbilical cord and the placenta is never a defense mechanism against those hormones. So when kids these days, you know, 70% of our children these days have cradle cap, which is something that there was nothing of that beforehand, right? Prior to the probably early 90s, I would say, nobody had something like that. Well, I do believe that probably it is rooted in a hormonal disbalance that the mother passed along through the placenta and the umbilical cord. Mm-hmm. And then those kind of played along with the thyroid function for the children, right? And that's something that we're doing really not a disservice to all children. I was actually checking their hormones. I do believe that is a huge gap there where we are not pediatrically looking into potentially some of these cortisol levels, some of these exogenic levels, and just blaming histamine for, you know, a little trigger from a food allergy or something like that can potentially just not be the root cause.
They'll grow out of it.
Exactly. Right? That's exactly what they told me, right? They'll just grow out of it. It's going to take some time. Just try to ride the wave until then, right? So this is how I discovered actually Dr. Repeat and just the hormone kind of disbalancement discussion online, and where I actually started taking a lot of the responsibility for what happened to my son as well. There was other things that definitely triggered, but I do believe I did have a big responsibility on passing along some of these potential hormones or other minerals, like potentially extra iron inside the placenta, heavy metals, who knows? And it kind of made me question, you know, what role as mothers do we have here, and how I can help potential future mothers and future couples to conceive in a way where kids are not triggered by this mast cell activation. Mm-hmm. We do not have these histamine reactions that are coming from a pediatric, which then induces into asthmatic tendencies, right? They can have issues with, obviously the gut microbiome takes an impact from that, you know, and it's a cycle, right? Histamine creates estrogen, estrogen creates histamine. And then we're in a world of a Ouroboros, how we call that, the snake that eats his own tail, right? So that's for the pediatric use, but definitely for women as well, we see a big tendency between histamine reactions and excess estrogen. But then you have to wonder, where is it coming from? What is actually the root cause here? Is it a thyroid function? Is it epigenetics? Is it biological stressors like environmental? Is there mold? Is there candida that is just creating a chronic systematic inflammation inside the body where things are not where they're supposed to be placed? The endotoxins are in the bloodstream, going into the brain, going into the breast tissue, going into the uterus. And is that what is creating here the dysbiosis? So, and that is also probably fed and grows at the same time excess estrogen, right? So well, stress, mental stress, I do believe the parents a big role of it. I do believe that environmental stressors are one of the biggest parts of just hormonal disbalancement and excess estrogen, and that's what I usually focus on with my clients, to try to find more the root cause from an epigenetic biological stressor way.
Wow. Yeah, you know, you said it earlier about in regards to taking responsibility, not like it's your fault per se, but just like I did have a role in this, because I was thinking about my mom, and she was kind of early on, she was on one of the first forms of Premarin. And so she was just, you know, riddled with migraines and all, and the welts, the histamine, the scratching, the itching, all these things. And she told me that my grandmother, who I never met, she used to take her hair comb out of her hair and scratch her legs until they were bleeding. She would just sit at the table and just scratch herself. And I was like, you know, these things kind of existed before, yes, but now it seems like it's just so prevalent. And it's a perfect storm. It's, or a layer cake more like. It's like there's so many things, like you said. So the problem is finding a practitioner. Well, now it's not, because we know you, but finding a practitioner, you know, somebody who is qualified enough to look at that layer cake and say, how many different things are contributing to all the things that are happening to you right now? So where do you start with that? I mean, so, you know, I had never even heard of using stinging nettles for histamine. Now I know I'm going sort of off here, but I've used it for liver detox and things like that, but I never thought about it until you shared that post into the group. And Sharon, my moderator and dear friend, has been just shouting from the rooftops about stinging nettles. And now I like, it's just like my infused water every day. And it's incredible. So, you know, there are things we can do ourselves, but what do you have to say about like addressing, like where would you begin? Where would someone begin who's one of the women in the group who's just like, I can't take it anymore? Where do I start?
Right. So most of my clients that actually have some of these issues, they already are on the pro-metabolic journey, or they have found Morley Robbins, or they have been mineralizing with oysters and beef liver, and they still can't find a quality of lifestyle that was or previously back like they remembered to, or they're just dreaming and having goals of. And this is where I probably come along. So some of the work has already been done, because I never actually want to kind of go and start working with somebody without being fully remineralized, and the liver has its own components. If there was a birth control, we do know that there's, you know, a lot of deficiencies that some of these medications can create. So it is quite important to start with a body and a terrain that is back to where it belongs, right? Full of magnesium, full of vitamin C, full of vitamin E, B12, B6, B1. So that is probably my first layers, to make sure that these women have everything needed to create energy, right? And this is where the pro-metabolic diet does come in. And very much suggested at first. So my first kind of peeling of the onion is always going to be something like that, where we're recommending a very pro-metabolic diet. Definitely depending on where the person is in the region or in the world, it will change, because we do have an effect about the sunlight and how we, you know, kind of digest and metabolize carbs. So that will always be taken in consideration. And then we're going to go into potentially just symptoms based. Like you were saying, your mom was scratching all the time, right? So I've been trained and I've been looking and researching to understand that that potentially can be candiditis, right? Or in this case, the histamine reaction, can it be from a food that has been triggering something in the body where it's a full-blown reaction to that food? So often we recommend potentially eliminating something at first, just to make sure, especially food, just to kind of slow down the chronic inflammation. And then we'll go in and kind of work with the gut. And then we'll go in and make sure that the bowel movements are well taken care of, because that is definitely the first of the funnel, right? We want to make sure that you're pooping properly, you're peeing properly, because that fermentation is going to create even worse endotoxins inside the body, right? So we're going towards a funnel way of doing things. So ruminalization will be step one. Step two, to make sure that, you know, the bowel movements are taken care of and you're pooping properly. We're using things like Casaraga, magnesium, vitamin C. These are all potentially vitamin C and magnesium deficiencies. We try to, again, remineralize first, and then we'll go in and potentially do a little bit more inner work to, you know, dismantle some of these endotoxins. Is it created by the estroblome, where, you know, beta-glucuronidase are just creating this excess, you know, excess estrogen that is reabsorbed? Is it mold? So we're going to look into your family history. Did your mom have dysbiosis? Does your sister have dysbiosis? Does anyone else have allergies? Is anyone have chronic sinusitis? All these are giving me clues, because I was trained to understand that what it could potentially be triggered by. And, you know, working with a practitioner, I do believe is quite important, because online you can really find a lot of information about symptoms and potentially targeting something with somebody taking you on a journey that might be, you know, not a career, but I mean, like a research point for that practitioner might be a good idea to kind of target well. And then, you know, some people do have budget for functional testing. I don't believe something like a functional testing, like an elimination, like a food sensitivity test, is something I do recommend. But potentially sometimes, you know, a mold test, potentially a candida test, a parasite test, a GI map, a Dutch test can be potentially something we look into as well, but not a necessity. I much prefer working at first with symptom base and family history, understanding dysbiosis. And then if we're hitting a roadblock, then the test would definitely come in and try to understand a little bit more.
Oh, nice. So I like that concept of like almost like calming the body down first, because so many people, and this is a really common issue in the group that you might have seen, is that, you know, people are at the peak of their histamine and inflammatory conditions and autoimmune issues, and maybe they have mold exposure, all these different things, and then they jump onto progesterone, and right. Now you've got these kickbacks and these reactions, and, you know, and it's like the progesterone it's the progesterone's fault. I've ruined my body, you know. And it's like, I like this idea of, all right, let's first calm things down and then start to chip away at the, you know, things like progesterone and histamine. But the histamine is really tricky, because I feel like there's symptoms of histamine that women, like, I didn't realize insomnia could be a histamine thing. I had no idea. I always think, when I think histamine, I think of hives and rashes. I don't think of anything else. What are some of the other signs that you've got some histamine issues and candida? Well, okay. Real quick, the candida and the histamine, aren't those kind of like go hand in hand, or you can have one and not have the other? I mean,
it really depends how you look at it. If the histamine is coming out of like an autoimmune disease, you know, I do believe that the body is never self-attacking, right? We just don't have the tools to understand the dysbiosis. So they're thinking that, you know, there is autobodies that are attacking the healthy tissue. But now we're starting to see that there's actually microbiomes in places where we didn't believe there was microbiomes, like the uterus, the brain, you know, the blood. Now we have research that shows that the blood of somebody that has autoimmune, when they actually try to look for more that terrain theory, the bacteria, the fungus, the toxins, they can find 3,000 to 5,000 different species of new bacteria that they've never found before. This is relatively new research that they just came out of. So they're trying, they're almost, research in general, allopathic research is starting to kind of almost have like an eye opening of that potentially there is no autoimmune. Maybe we are attacking something else in the body that is, you know, coming from an epigenetic perspective or just a dysbiosis in the microbiome. So candiditis can be, histamine and candida can come hand in hand, but it doesn't necessarily have to be fungus. It can be also bacterial. It could be HPV, it can be H. pylori. All of those can create some chronic systemic inflammation in the body. The only problem is that the candida, right, it often comes along with all these things. So when you have Lyme disease, it does come with candida issues. When you have mold, it comes with candida parasites, it comes with candida. The fungus, I feel like it's always there to kind of, in a way, potentially protect the person while at the same time doing his job of which is disintegrating, right? Like when candida is taking over, it's because the gut has almost been so depleted of the healthy microbiome or just the ecosystem in general, bad and good, that almost the body seems like it's thinking it's dead. So candida is kind of going inside and kind of trying to kind of just go and start, you know, decomposing things. And this is where we need to come in. And this is why it's so hard to kind of find the balance between, you know, pushing it back, but not too much, because it is still something that we have inside of us. It's dormant. We can never always kill it. We just have to push it back to levels where the ecosystem is in a better balanced way. And this is where the histamine definitely comes in, where it's a bit of a fight, I find, with a histamine that is related to candida in general, but it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be candida related. Histamine can just come from an overexcitement of excess estrogen in the body. It could come in from other different pollutants like heavy metals, which could potentially create some thyroid functions. We do have, you know, links to heavy metals that are hidden in the tissues of the thyroid, creating hot autoimmune like Hashimoto's. We do have a lot of research on lead and cadmium, especially, which act like estrogen receptors, like estrogen and attached to estrogen receptors. So then the histamine kind of comes in to potentially just, you know, it's just mass creating because we have this excitement, this chronic inflammation inside the body from a different toxicity than candida. So it is a multidimensional kind of a target. You just have to really figure out what is the dysbiosis here for the person and probably target that way. So this is where usually functional testing can come in and help a little bit if the person is willing to go that route.
Wow. That's interesting what you said about, you know, the candida being there as a decomposer, or, you know, my mentor used to say that it's a secondary infection. Like if you're having symptoms of candida, not just candida, because like you said, we all have it, but if you're having symptoms of candida overgrowth, that it's like the secondary infection. And, if you try to do a candida cleanse, a full-on candida cleanse, and you're killing off this candida, that you could potentially be liberating whatever it is that it's trying to sequester or kill off or whatever. And that's just so fascinating because it makes sense, because some people will do those cleanses and they'll get so much, they'll get sicker, right? They'll just get more ill. So I jumped on two questions back a minute ago, and I'll go back to that one, which was, I didn't realize that histamine can be causing so many different types of reactions. And I think of scratching and itching and hives, but insomnia. And then there was things like brain fog, allergies. So hormonally related, like around your cycle when women get allergy. I never had this, thank God, but I see it constantly where women are like, every time I get near my cycle, I get a flare up, or sometimes it just depends on the time of their cycle too. It can be they're about to start their period. It could just be PMS. It can be during their period, and sometimes even in their luteal phase. And all of a sudden they'll have the most symptoms and they'll get some kind of allergic stuffy nose, sneezing, even they'll get sick. They'll get, what is it called? Like the drip in the back of the throat, and they'll get, you know, congestion and a cough. So can you talk about, I know you just did, but what, right. You know, that can be the estrogen component. Where, why is it flaring up then at those times? Like it's related to the cycle.
Right. So this is where I still believe it could be epigenetic and biological stress, because we do know that when, you know, in the luteal phase, potentially if your progesterone levels are too low and your estrogen is too high, which most women that do have PMS symptoms can fall in that category, right? That excess estrogen in the body will feed And will create environments of dysbiosis, right? Like we do know bacterial vaginosis are often found in women that or are in pregnancies or are on the birth control pill because that excess estrogen is coming in and feeding that environment of the bacteria, right? We do know Prevotella, which is a gum disease related a bacteria, feeds on estrogen as well. This is why, again, on birth control or when you're pregnant, you have cavities, right? So I believe it's actually a synergy between pathogens and excess estrogen. And if you do have that period flu or that, you know, that those symptoms of potentially histamine reactions, you're having a cough, a mucus, then you must ask yourself questions. Why are you building mucus? What is the role of mucus? The role of mucus is to protect yourself, right? It's there to mop up toxins, dust, pollen, allergies, right? So when it's getting built up and that excess histamine is telling, you know, your body, create mucus in the body, what exactly is that telling you? Is that telling you that potentially it's mopping up something here that could potentially create some allergic reactions or some dysbiosis in the body? Or is it the fact that you're not able to potentially clean some of this excess estrogen through the liver? It's a bit on the sluggish side of things. There's no sulfur, right? So when you do eat some things like eggs potentially, or you have a little bit of that tendency to kind of go a little bit, you know, towards the carbs during the luteal phase or during the PMS phase, that sugar or that iron inside the gluten, whatever you feel like that dysbiosis comes from, that, you know, those little bit of a refined carbs will feed on some of these bacteria that will be in a environment that excess estrogen that is going to be prolific for them. So I still believe it's actually less hormone related and more epigenetics and bacterial related.
Wow. That's so interesting. So the estrogen, you know, Morley Robbins said this the other day on my show. He said, you know, he sees estrogen as a type of antioxidant, and he thinks that, you know, it's coming in to, because of the excess iron, the toxic iron. And so, and that's because of a lack of bioavailable copper. And then he, you know, I said to him, you know, you take a scalpel to everything and you get really down to the layers of the mineral, dysregulation and stuff. What do you think about that? You think that there's some truth to the fact, because why the heck is estrogen so prevalent and it's so abundant, and the older we get, it just goes into our tissues and doesn't show up in the blood, and now we think we're estrogen deficient, and then we take estrogen, and now it's just, why is there so much of it if it's so potent and dangerous? It's got to be doing something, right?
Absolutely. We do know there's a lot of healthy balance to estrogen, right? It helps regulate menstrual cycle. It helps, you know, with tissue, with bones, with heart, right? So there is a definitely good balance of it. Unfortunately, I believe that we are exposed to certain things that are actually aging us quite fast as women. We're not aging as gracefully anymore. The excess iron coming in potentially, you know, is feeding bacteria or pathogens. It's creating oxidative stress. It's accumulating where the PUFAs and the polyunsaturates are, right? And creating lipofuss skin, which is, you know, some big oxidative stress kind of injuries to the liver, to the tissue. So we're in a way where excess estrogen, for me, it's more of a result potentially of some of these injuries that are created by our environment, right? I know that Morley thinks that potentially, you know, it's estrogen coming after the iron, but we do know that excess estrogen retains more iron, right? And copper as well. So when we do have women on birth control pill on the hair mineral test, for example, we can see elevated levels of iron inside those levels, or we see elevated copper as well. And sometimes copper can be doing good, like ceruloplasmin, right? And then sometimes copper can also oxidize and create some dysbiosis, in my opinion. So it is a very much of a relationship where I believe actually the metals or potentially the toxins or the bacteria comes first, and then it kind of rises some of these excess estrogen, which creates again that snowball effect of feeding each other out and creating some of these dysbiosis.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. It makes me think about the histamine, estrogen, iron, histamine, estrogen, iron, and I'm forgetting something else that just seems to be, oh, the PUFA. So, I was thinking about, how Morley's like, you know, when you stop bleeding as a woman, you really should give blood. I mean, he thinks you should give blood anyway.
Right.
But I was thinking about this because I'm now like, I think I'm into menopause. I keep saying that and then I have a period, but I think I'm into it now. But I'm noticing like there's like the liver spot, the ones that existed just getting darker. And I thought this has to be like a lipofuscin, iron, PUFA, you know, melasma, all these things that you see on people as they get older, you know, they just get darker and darker and darker, and then they're covered with these spots. And it's definitely all part of the same like spider's nest, I feel like.
Right.
Hello, quick interruption to tell you about the in-home dried urine Dutch Complete hormone test. It's not enough to just know your levels, high or low, but for example, what are you doing with your estrogen? Is it being pushed down unhealthy, potentially dangerous pathways that could lead to breast or prostate cancer, fibroids, or insulin resistance? Or are you converting your testosterone into estrogen and having hair loss and low libido? Or are your adrenals burnt out and at the root of all your hormonal struggles? No point in guessing. I love this test. I take it once a year and it keeps me on track with my goal of aging gracefully. Use your coupon ED25 as in estrogen dominance 25 and get $25 off your test interpretation and 6-week program of supplement, detox, and dietary recommendations. I have 5 years of experience reading and interpreting this test and was trained by the makers Precision Analytical. Coupled with my gut health expertise, and this program is about as comprehensive as you're going to get. Check it out in the show notes for more details.
Okay, so Constantine had some wonderful questions and he wanted me to just hit on them. But he summed it up here to ask you about some of these substances. Let's talk about L-histidine first. What is it and what should we know about it?
Okay, so L-histidine is an amino acid that is found one of the building blocks of protein. L-histidine has been not seen as an essential amino acid. It's kind of in the backlog. We don't really need it because we just have enough of it, or it's not being created by the body itself. So it's been put on the backlog. It also has a little bit of a bad rep because it says that it's been feeding histamine. So watch out with L-histidine. It's going to feed histamine, which is true. The reservoir of histidine is rooted in L-histidine, but we also know that L-histidine is a precursor to SOD, we know, which is a huge antioxidant, which helps exactly with reducing inflammation and making sure that the dysbiosis is kind of kept at calm. So L-histidine has a lot more, roots than actually just creating histamine. And I started to kind of see a lot of positive effects when it came to skin issues. Like I've seen a lot of research that L-histidine, when administered to adults in general, especially those with atopic dermatitis, they actually seen as much improvement as using a topical cortisol. Why? Because we are feeding some of these other roots that are not talking about, which for skin, it's actually needed to feed what we call filigreens. Filigreens are the binding protein of the skin that sometimes people or have a gene mutation and it starts breaking. Some Europeans have that issue. That's what they believe. Sometimes the eczema can come from a gene mutation, or just in general, filigreens can be potentially put under stress, especially in as a fetus or as a baby with all these chemicals and kind of endocrine disruptors around us, the filigreens can start disintegrating. So L-histidine has shown to be really, really improving with that as well. So this is where I was, I got a lot of inspiration from, and I found that organs have a lot of L-histidine, especially desiccated kidneys, which also has DAO, which is kind of a beautiful combination together to kind of help histamine reaction go low. And I started administering that to my child, and we've seen really, really good benefits from it. And a lot of people are like, you shouldn't be doing that. You're going to be creating more histamine. But actually, the fact that there was none in the reservoir, because histamine was producing at such high rate, was actually getting things worse. So making the reservoir full again of L-histidine calm down the mast cell activation that was made by histamine and reduce the symptoms. And hopefully, I believe that might have played a role in him actually starting to not react to certain foods that he needed an EpiPen before, like dairy or certain nuts and peanuts. And
interesting. Okay. So you found that out on your own. Did you also see some research regarding that, or is that was just something you experimented with?
No, I found some research on it. I was researching heavy metals at that point from just my perspective, understanding if I gave something to my child, or from a the medication perspective, it is a reality, especially for my child. It was a reality with the medication and the injection. So I was looking at that, and I realized that actually the protein that goes inside our body and detoxifies us of heavy metals is rooted in L-histidine. And if there's no L-histidine, there's none of these proteins that are going and actually chelating some of these heavy metals. So then I started looking into that. I started looking into eczema, seeing if there was maybe potentially a connection there, because I was trying to kind of place the pieces together. And yes, lo and behold, there was also a connection between a deficiency in L-histidine and a lot of atopic dermatitis. And when administering it, it seemed to be working very, very well at very big doses, which meant it was quite safe. It is amino acid. It didn't create any deficiency. So I was able to put the puzzle together with research. Yes.
Interesting. And you feel like so you mentioned something about Europeans or Caucasians, that there's European, like a different genetic component to that. And that's, so that's your son as well. You feel like there might be a genetic component. Well, you were saying there's many things that contributed.
Right. I try not to think about that, because that's not something I could potentially change. We do know that there might be a genetic component that does modify with epigenetics. So we know we can alter some of these modifications from a DNA perspective. So, but I wasn't really focusing more on that. I was focusing on understanding, why is he creating histamine to the point where he is creating histamine? Why is he reacting to everything? And just apply that afterwards to my clients and understand that potentially it might be a deficiency. Mm-hmm. And even amino acids like L-histidine might be a potential deficiency there, and we can calm the body by not only focusing on minerals but also focusing on amino acids.
Interesting. Okay. And then so let's talk about melatonin. So there's so many mixed reviews on on melatonin. What's your perspective?
Right. So of course I went down the rabbit hole of being vilified by melatonin. I do understand that there is a lot of research that has shown that potentially, you know, it is a hormone that if you do play along with it for too long, you could start, stop making it. So there is that side of the story. It's true. But then we are in a new world where melatonin actually acts more like an antioxidant. And yes, it's true. If you do have just insomnia issues, let's just put it that way, and you're not able to peel the onion, understand what is going on, potentially, you know, not, you know, it might be a job or a place in your life where you're just not able to change. Is that something that you can use part of a protocol until you can, a little bit like a medication, until you understand what's going on in your life or lifestyle choices or diet to kind of rectify? I would highly recommend using something like that. And I use it for my clients that have dysbiosis, like endometriosis. We have a lot of research that has shown that melatonin acts like an antioxidant for endometriosis, and can potentially, even if you're sleeping quite okay, it could potentially even increase some of that detoxification agency, right? Because we do detoxify during the sleep, and melatonin is the trigger for that. And potentially you might need a little bit more at that point. So some of my PCOS clients, some of my endometriosis clients, I will recommend it, but always part of it, a protocol. So we will never want to be on it forever, but I have no issues on the safety of it to include it at a protocol to understand exactly, to give somebody a better chance of making better lifestyle choices, right? If you're going to be less in pain, if you're going to have, you know, a better time kind of weight managing, or have a clearer mind, less brain fog, then you will want to make those dietary changes. You will want to go and have, you know, a couple of minutes to do some exercise, or, you know, have a little bath that, you know, is going to give you some sort of relief from other problems in your life. So I do believe that potentially some of these products that are vilified can be worked on during a protocol for fertility or just metabolic diseases like endometriosis, PCOS.
I'm a huge fan of it, and my mentor was a huge fan of it. And you know, I before he passed away, I should have, and I didn't get this study from him, which was an Italian doctor. Maybe you know about it. He took these twin teenagers, and he followed them along for, I think, 10 years, or maybe they were already in their early 20s. And they were twins, twin women, and he gave one of them quite high doses of melatonin every day, every night. And I think it was even like, I want to say 25 milligrams. Okay. and didn't give the other anything. And it was like a 10-year thing where he followed them to the end, and he had photos, and I'll never forget this. He had the two photos of them side by side after 10 years. And so they were probably 30 or so. And the one that didn't have the melatonin looked like she could have been the other's mom.
Wow.
Like that was the difference. And Dr. Marshall used to say, my mentor used to say, it is the anti-aging hormone. It is the main anti-aging antioxidant hormone. And so I've been taking it. I mean, I do take breaks for sure, especially now, but earlier on for years, probably 6 or 7 years, I was taking it all the time and I never noticed anything. Now, what do you say to women who are like, I can't take it because I have nightmares or it gives me really disturbed sleep? What is that action? Do you know?
Mm-hmm. I do believe it's rooted in mineral deficiencies at that point. How are your magnesium levels? How is your B complex? Are you able, is your liver able to detoxify during that time? We know we have a lot of women that do wake up during the night because of their liver is sluggish. It is a traditional Chinese medicine way of looking at things. It's true. It's completely different. Another different branch of naturopathic medicine, but potentially some of these women need to work a little bit more on opening some of the detox pathways to, and remineralize first before going towards melatonin, because you know a body that goes to sleep, even if it's not artificial in a way, but in a way the body is a bit of like progesterone. You're kind of including something that the body's not able to create at that point. It doesn't work by itself, right? So it needs to make sure that everything is kind of in order at the same time. So for somebody like that, I would highly recommend potentially looking into your liver, making sure you know that you have your magnesium, your vitamin C, your sulfur amino acids are in there, your B complex is in there, your detox pathway 1 and 2 is open at that point, and potentially at that point retrying and seeing if that might be in a better place. But I do believe that they work hand in hand, the liver and melatonin, and that connection can definitely create some side effects if one of them is not working properly.
Interesting. I heard, and I don't know how true this is, but maybe you can speak about it, that people who do a lot of like benzodiazepines or recreational drug like psilocybin, things like this, that these things can occupy melatonin receptors. And so when you take melatonin, it can like clear it out. And then for the first, it's almost like you have to clear the receptors for the first few days to be able to then utilize the melatonin properly. Does that make any sense? It would certainly would explain the nightmares and the weird dreams, right? Because of maybe it's kicking in some mushroom trips you had 10 years ago into your system while you're sleeping.
Yeah, well, we do have a lot of these different, I don't know exactly for melatonin and these drugs, I'm going to be very honest, I haven't researched that much this antioxidant in general as a hormone. I use it very lightly, but it's not a tool that I use often. So I don't know exactly when it comes to these type of receptors, but we do know receptors can be kind of taken over by other things, right? That mimic a little bit. We do see that also with mold and estrogen, right? We see that also with heavy metals. We see that also with mineral mimicking, like lead can mimic calcium. So I can speak to that in other different levels, but I don't know exactly for melatonin. It's not something that I'm professionally like really on top of.
It sounds interesting. Like it could be true.
Very, 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 absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about vitamin C.
Yes. Vitamin C. Yes.
That post you posted it today, that tweet you shared was a big one.
The endometriosis?
The vitamin C and E. Yeah.
Yes. The vitamin C, we see a lot of, dysbiosis in terms of antioxidant levels when it comes to metabolic diseases, especially endometriosis, PCOS, excess estrogen and dominance. We have a lot of research that has shown that if we take the fluid away from, let's say, the uterus at that point, from women that do experience some of these disbalancement in their lives and some of these diagnoses, their levels of vitamin C and E are going to be extremely low. So we do know that that might potentially be because, or there is an oxidative stress kind of environment in there, right? right? With the vitamin E, meaning that potentially PUFAs are taking a little bit too much over, or iron is present a little bit too much, which we know depletes vitamin E by quite a substantial amount. And then vitamin C as well, it's much needed in the eyes and the adrenals, but also in the uterus. So someone that has recurrent abortions, recurrent, obviously infertility, is not able to get pregnant, in fibroids from endometriosis or uterine fibroids in general, ovarian cysts, when we take that fluid, it's often very low in both of those antioxidants. So for me, that's a huge a component of my protocols. I often include them both together, and we see a lot of very positive effects by just including a little bit more of that from a diet perspective or from a supplementation perspective. A lot of my clients see a lot of relief from a lot of symptoms when it comes to that duo. It's because they actually work so much together. So yeah, it also helps with EMF as well. EMF can potentially create a lot of oxidative stress in areas where that EMF can be looking for, right? So because there is a lot of iron, let's say, in the tissues of endometriosis or ovarian cysts, you know, that metal does, it is a metal, right? At the end of the day. So it could potentially be pulling some of that radioactivity towards it. So seeing some of that vitamin C and E can also affect potentially your EMF protection, which can impact infertility, impact, you know, menstrual cycles, hormonal balance, and all that stuff. So I love it.
Good. That's so interesting. You know, I've all my life, I'm like, I'm so sensitive. You know, and you hear, I have clients that are like, I'm just so sensitive to everything. And they write it off. And I used to write it off like, oh, because I'm different. I'm unique. My body's different. And I'm not saying that they aren't and that I wasn't, but really what you're saying is, you know, you're depleted. And that's why you're sensitive. People will say, oh, I'm very sensitive to EMFs and to energy. And I'm like, I'm an energetic guru. I'm so sensitive. It's like, are you, or are you depleted and your body can't handle the effects of being near, you know, I mean, it's not good for anybody, is it? The 5G and all this stuff. It's not good to constantly be inundated with these things, but you know, people like that don't feel it at all, who are quite healthy, you know, it's like, well, they're probably just have the tools their body needs to, you know, deal with all of these assaults, let's call it. Right. That's so interesting. And yeah. Okay. Vitamin C. What about ascorbic acid versus Kamu-Kamu and the whole food vitamin C? Do you mind? Do you care? What do you prefer?
Right. So there depends on the protocol, depends on the diagnosis. Somebody that has infertility, I will include more of a natural perspective to things. Like I'll include more of a acerola or a Kamu-Kamu vitamin C, because we do know that the flavonoids, vitamin P, as they call it back in the day, does play a role. And both of them synergistically together can potentially be more helpful than just going the ascorbic acid way. So most of the time I will start with an acerola or a whole food vitamin C, because that flavonoids are quite an important perspective. The bromelain, the quercetin, especially with PCOS, a lot of elderberries are going to be quite important. Some of those berries are a little bit on the brown, purple and red side of things. That vitamin C kind of perspective, the cherries have a lot of both the vitamin C and quercetin, which can be a little bit more helpful than just vitamin C from ascorbic acid. But with that being said, you know, we do have now ascorbic acid that is made in Scotland out of lemons, not out of mold in China, right? There is trademarks right now of vitamin C's where they have acknowledged that, you know, the past has been a little bit more, you know, manipulated towards the productivity profit versus actually quality of the vitamin. So now there is ascorbic acids out there that are clearly purified in places where, you know, the standards are a little bit more high. Something like that I will be using on a client that potentially needs some kind of relief or something for an IVF journey in the next month, you know, or she really is on a time crunch because, you know, her age is kind of catching up to her and, you know, she would like to get pregnant in the next 3 to 6 months. In that case, potentially having ascorbic acid as a tool might be necessary. And I will always stay open to understanding budget and also timeline, which will give me and will make me understand which supplement to use at that point. Because we do know something like acerola, can, you know, with the manipulation, the transport, the warehouses, the vitamin C in some of these fruit supplements can reduce by just being in the bottle, right? A little bit like omega-3s can turn rancid inside the bottles, right? From the heat and the manipulation. The whole food vitamin C's does go through the same kind of process as well. So giving something like that to somebody that is looking to kind of enhance her fertility very, very soon, you're a bit risking it, right? So I will go the ascorbic acid that way. And we now have a lot of research to show that ascorbic acid is vitamin C at the end of the day. The receptors inside the gut pull ascorbic acid. There's no complex vitamin C. Ascorbic acid is vitamin C. And then the flavonoids are complementary. They are a combination, but they're two different departments. They're not combined, let's say, under the whole, in the system and in the terrain. They're not combined together. It will select ascorbic acid as the vitamin C, our own terrain.
That's good to hear you say that. I always say, take like the Acerola products and the natural vitamin C products as maintenance on the regular. Right. And then when I, like, especially with COVID, people, I would get texts. I'm sure you did too. At all hours, my throat is sore. My mom is sick. I've been with her all weekend, you know, and I'm like, just get that. No Acerola berries here, honey. Let's get that ascorbic acid and do mega doses of vitamin C to get, you know, that boost that you need. So I'm glad to hear you say that. I want to back up 1 minute because I forgot about a question of melatonin and the Dutch test. So I've been finding, and thanks to Constantine, who's just a genius, he was saying, so when I see people that have really high melatonin, like off the charts, and they do not supplement, well, before I go any further, what do you think about that? Someone who has extremely high melatonin does not supplement. I know there's no other, I'll give you some more. They almost always have some gut issues, major gut issues. Yeah. Like, and depression, like some high serotonin issues. Yeah. So again, with the antioxidant, melatonin being the antioxidant, right? Maybe it's getting in there. It's high. Maybe they're overproducing it to try to, I don't know. What do you think?
Right. So yes, absolutely. That's exactly where my mind was going. If something is high, it doesn't mean it can be detrimental. It means it's probably just much more needed. And it's actually looking to scavenger for something, right? So when we see that something like melatonin is an antioxidant is going high, or, you know, like even in a hair mineral test, when we see magnesium being very high, a lot of people are like, oh my God, I have a lot of magnesium in me. It's like, no, actually your burn rate of magnesium is extremely high. So potentially on a Dutch test, if the melatonin is quite high, it's potentially the burn rate of your melatonin, your antioxidant levels are quite high. So what is exactly scavenging for it? Is looking for the endotoxins in the bloodstream, trying to blocking that, you know, brain barrier to make sure that it's not getting to places where, you know, we want to protect as much as possible. That's why there's a blood brain barrier. Or is it looking for, you know, fungus or pathogens? I do believe that antioxidants are, when it's a bit of a higher levels in the blood, especially like ceruloplasmin as well, that is kind of telling me and giving me an insight that potentially you're using things that should be on the calmer side of things. And if it's high, it means we need to look deeper, not just make sure that we calm down serotonin, but why is serotonin being created, right? We do know that bacteria can create their own serotonin. So,
really?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Bacteria can create its own serotonin. It has been shown in vivo and in vitro. So sometimes when people are like, you know, we have to watch out with the serotonin foods, making sure it's like, no, actually let's focus more on the bacteria that potentially, you know, they got to the point where the dysbiosis has been debalanced, and now they're creating their own kind of their own kind of hormones too, because they have their own hormones, right? They have everything that we have almost, right? So when when they have these things that are coming out and you're high serotonin, it might not be the gut mobility, it might actually be your own bacteria creating that serotonin.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah. It's the serotonin talk is extremely interesting, I find, because a bit like everything else, a little bit potentially can be good. But these days we do see a lot of it getting produced and we wonder why, right? So it could be potentially from something like, you know, fibers that are a little bit on the rougher side of things. So then the gut mobility, which is the creator also of serotonin, can potentially be dysbiosis, you know, creating dysregulations. And then your serotonin kind of just stays inside and ruminates inside your gut. IBS is rooted in high serotonin. We do have a lot of these kind of intestinal tract disbalances that are often rooted in high serotonin. Or I do believe that we should be looking into your bacterial overload as well and see if potentially some of these bacteria are creating their own serotonin. And that's what we should be targeting, not potentially, you know, the intestinal tract membrane, but the bacteria itself.
Interesting. It makes me wonder then about the Dutch when people have really, really, really right. high progesterone and they're, you know, 35 years old, they have normal, maybe low estrogen, and they have just like crazy high estrogen. Now we know the Dutch is excretion. So we know right. it's like, okay, so what do you think about that? Like high, high, high progesterone levels, but they're exhibiting signs of estrogen dominance.
I believe that might be a defense mechanisms again, right? We do know that in the places of like gallbladder, when there is stones inside the gallbladder, your own gallbladder is actually going to create progesterone receptors to try to calm down the place itself, the space itself. We do know that this actually also happens in places like the uterus, where your uterus is actually going to start creating receptors of progesterone as an almost as an antioxidant somewhere down the road to kind of come and relax and reduce the chronic inflammation. So when I see high progesterone, I'm going to start asking some questions like, you know, is the gallbladder okay? Are you calcifying some stones here? Is your bile able to take care of some of this excess estrogen? Or is there a disconnection over there? How's your uterus? What are we doing in terms of, you know, health over there? Are you having any fibroids or cysts or something like that? Because we create progesterone receptors in places where we see dysbiosis.
Wow. I'm learning so much. Okay.
Very interesting stuff.
Yeah. And you know, since we're on the Dutch quickly, you know, we know that when someone has a stagnant liver and a sluggish bowel and they've got endotoxin and they're recycling their estrogen, oftentimes right. we'll see that they're a low methylator. But what about when they're an overmethylator? What's happening with that?
So they're excess, the dominant in estrogen, and they're a high methylator.
Yeah. Or I've seen different combinations of it where I just see that that one marker is high and I'm like, what? I wonder what exactly is going on here with this over methylation. I don't even really know what that means.
Right. So overmethylation for me, it might seem like there might be an issue with potentially fat soluble toxins. Fat soluble toxins are often like mold, like ZEAs, which are also estrogenic in tendencies as well. So when I see overmethylation, I'm thinking that potentially we need to target some of these different toxins, which can come out of the liver in form of bile. And it's just trying to create a place where we're pushing these things out. Unfortunately, excess estrogen makes the bile viscous. This is known in research. It just becomes very sticky. This is why we also have issues with the gut afterwards, is because the bile is not often functionally properly. And I speak a lot about taurine. I speak a lot about tutka in general, because I do believe there's a huge bile component here, which gives a lot of relief to the liver. And when it's not present in its regular consistency or in its regular flow, we do see some of these kind of other detox pathways kind of overexcite and work, like potentially the overmethylation.
Wow. Okay. You mentioned tutka and taurine. Some people may not know what that's all about. And a lot of women do, and they're taking it. So these are nutrients. Tutka, what is tutka exactly? It's not a nutrient, is it?
No, so tutka is a bile acid that is combined with taurine to make the bile acid called tutka. It helps eliminate excess estrogen inside the liver. And it also helps a lot with the estroblom. It makes sure that estroblom is quite well regulated and there's no actually reabsorption. So I use a lot of tutka actually in my practice, because I do believe that it has not only from a toxicity perspective, because like I said, there's a lot of the toxicity that is a fat soluble toxins, but also because of that estroblom, I want to make sure that is completely well monitored, and it needs a lot of bile to make sure that we move things around from the liver into the GI tract where it belongs. So
wow.
I think it's a quite important tool that a lot of people forget, that bile is even more important than the microbiome, because it's the step before, right? So between the liver and the gut, we have bile, and often, because we're all very much estrogen dominant, that bile is completely impaired.
Oh, geez. So, the estrobilome, for those listeners, is just the microbiome that would metabolizes estrogen in the bowel. Is that what you would sum it up as?
Exactly. It goes from the liver down to the bile, from the bile in the gut, and that portion of the microbiome makes sure that is excreted well. If it's not working properly, it goes back and gets reabsorbed by the gut and gets reabsorbed in the bloodstream. And this is what creates excess dominance of estrogen often. Mm.
And so what is I've noticed a common thing, including in myself with the TUDCA, is headaches. Is taking now, it could have been a combination of the taurine, the TUDCA, and niacinamide. Mm-hmm. But Constantine said, he thinks it was that I bought some garbage product because I had never taken TUDCA before. And I know that I definitely need it. But my instinct, you know, when you take something and you're like, it was that, you know, you kind of feel, I felt like it was the TUDCA. But I don't know. It was just an ongoing sort of low grade headache after the first couple of days. What would you say?
Interesting.
Sluggish liver.
I was just going to say, I'm assuming in that case, the detox pathway 2, it might not be that open. Detox pathway number 1 is often more open than not. So when we see headaches, it just means we're reabsorbing some of that excess estrogen. So potentially there might be a blockage from or the gut perspective, and it's creating some of these endotoxins again, or it's getting reabsorbed in the bloodstream and it's creating what we know as, you know, excess estrogen symptoms, which is mainly a lot of headaches. So it could be potentially that as well. Or in general, you know, taurine is a sulfur amino acid. So if you're, again, if that kind of sulfur pathway, the methylation pathway is not optimized, we can potentially have some side effects there too.
Mm. Or it was a garbage product.
Yeah, I'm not really sure which one.
I know. So I was just being cheap at the moment. Okay. But so... you mentioned sulfur though. Some women have an allergy to sulfur, right? They can't take sulfur. That just popped. I've gone way off track. You're just so fascinating and you have so many good answers, and I have questions in it that aren't on here. Okay. So, sulfur allergies, women that cannot tolerate sulfur, what's going on there?
Mm-hmm. Again, liver. I would just be working on the liver a lot. It seems like you're not tolerating something that is quite okay for us in small doses and much needed. It's actually what helps us methylate some of these issues. It's especially the excess hormones from our bodies. So I would make sure that your liver is well taken care of from an insulin perspective. Cholesterol is well established in there. The bile is flowing. Detox pathway 1 and detox pathway 2 are taken care of. Castor oil packs, anything that has to do with a lot of stress and angerness, potentially get your medication as well. Or is that something, you know, that you're taking that can potentially create some of this dysbiosis? There's a lot of fluoride and metals inside medication that can potentially just be impairing your liver as well. So the liver is definitely the first one that gets a lot of injuries, with the gut, as you know, the gut being quite present as well for the endotoxins, but we often work, especially for women, on the liver. Because that is where fertility is getting, you know, probably produced. That's where it gives the signal to the ovaries, right? So it's quite an important tool for women. So if you can't, if you're reacting to that thing that most people are not, it's not the sulfur, the problem. It's something within you that we need to be kind of regulating or correcting.
Right. Like Morley always says, don't blame the flies for the trash. Right. It's not the sulfur, right?
Well, it's a bit like eggs, right? Eggs too, they're very sulfurish. And I believe a lot of people are reacting to the eggs because of that sulfur. And that sulfur is kind of creating an excess histamine in the body because it's the liver is impaired at that point. It's a bit too sluggish. And then they get mucus, they get headaches, they get that histamine kind of reaction. Joint pain is one of them as well. And then they blame it on the eggs. But the eggs is just bringing that sulfur where it actually belongs. And potentially that organ is just not in the right place or having the facility to take it in and using and metabolizing the correct way.
Wow. And, you know, also the liver in terms of converting T4 to T3, right? And then that's all about metabolism and thyroid function, and then cholesterol, because that's something I've suffered with and so many women suffer with, is high cholesterol and then low levels of hormones. The conversions aren't happening. And that's a liver function, isn't it? And probably gut, of course.
Right. You can definitely work on both at the same time. And simultaneously would be a smart way to work on both at the same time, especially for something like this. So yeah, absolutely.
And then the last one that he had was asking about myo inositol. Yeah. And what you think about all that good stuff.
Yeah. So my inositol is a tool that, you know, I think as practitioners, we all have it in our toolbox for insulin resistance in general. It's something that I will often recommend to my PCOS ladies and my clients. It is something that we have seen quite a bit of research that has been successful in terms of regulating your insulin sensitivity back to normal. It also helps a little bit with that leptin hormone as well. So you can start regulating some of that satiation better than before with my inositol. It is a sugar at the end of the day. You can find it in plants. It is also quite predominant in goat milk as well, my inositol. It helps with cognitive decline, like depression. We've seen a lot of different applications with my inositol in general. And it does protect the liver against, it seems like, injury against also iron and glucose metabolism, something that some of these women, you know, in excess estrogen dominant situations are having a harder time kind of metabolizing and synthesizing. So my inositol is a good tool. I believe most practitioners these days uses them, especially for the PCOS community.
Great. Well, do you have anything you want to share with us that I maybe didn't touch on or?
Good question.
Knowing my group of women who are, you know, dosing progesterone, most of them are self-medicating. We've got women in my group, including myself, not anymore, but before, where the only way I would see benefit was 800 milligrams a day of topical progesterone. I could not tolerate any vitamin E. I would get nauseous taking vitamin E. So I couldn't even do Progest D at the time. That was the only one that was available.
Right.
And this is a lot of women. And so they're self-medicating.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. One thing that I would potentially like to mention is that we do know that in terms of men and women, our metabolic reaction to some of these hormones are completely different. I see a lot of women that when they start progesterone, they start increasing in weight. And that is a huge issue often for some of my clients, where I see on different groups of hormonal groups as well, where they start blaming the progesterone for some of that weight gain. So they start being afraid. And this is where potentially, like I said, some of that in-ground work is really important to understand potentially where the dysbiosis has happened. Is it nutritional? Is it stress related? Is it a toxin related? And work on that simultaneously as you potentially are dosing with some of these hormones like blood progesterone, which I use myself regularly. I love, but I know that I had to do a lot of inner work prior to that to make sure that my body will be able to handle that in a very natural, synergistic way. So for me, it was a birth control pill that was inside of me for 10 years. I knew there was a lot of mineral deficiencies that had impacted my liver, especially in the function of my liver. No more folate, no more B12, no more B6, no more magnesium. So that already kind of makes sure that the detox pathway 1 and 2 are impaired at that point, right? So when the progesterone would come in, the excess estrogen would have nowhere to go. It would be completely impaired by a sluggish liver, right? So I had to do a lot of inner work using some beef organs to make sure that I remineralize, using some magnesium as well. And then also working on my liver in terms of finding some of these potential heavy metals or mold or anything like that to kind of chelate the way and making sure that my liver is optimal for when the progesterone comes in, it's in an optimal shape to when it's pushing the estrogen out, it has a place to go out. And I think it's a bit more multi-dimensional than just using progesterone for women. It seems like for men, they use it a little bit with more ease, but for us women, it seems like we need to work a little bit more on our terrain and peel some onions.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such good advice. And we say that all the time in the group. It's like, I think one of the most important things is really to make sure you are, you know, your gut health is in order. You're working on that and you're working on liver function. I mean, even before I started working in the hormone world, I started, started to be in the home hormone world. I was doing the gut health world and that, you know, it's always like, you can't just start detoxing. You have to make sure your detox pathways are open or else you're going to get a clogged drain. And that's going to look like all kinds of your body trying to put out fires everywhere. Right. And that's what it feels like too, where you have inflammation all over the place and your body's just freaking out because you're doing the right things, but you just need to open those detox pathways.
Right, exactly. Like I the same thing with ascorbic acid. This is a tour where potentially like a laxative like cascara would come in, right? Just to kind of help the gut mobility and the GI tract kind of start cleaning there because of the fermentation accumulation from potentially a low thyroid function, low acid, stomach acid. And while you're potentially healing through progesterone creams or topical or oral, we might need to also kind of move the bowels away from, you know, that GI tract, not to create any bacteria overload, SIBO, candida, because it often comes with a low stomach acid, right? Like a low stomach acid is just a beautiful environment for some of these, you know, unfortunately kind of gut microbiome that tends to be on the negative side effects kind of things, creating endotoxins. So working simultaneously with exactly the gut, the liver, and your bowel movements are quite important. If you're constipated, I would work on that first and making sure, you know, you include that carrot salad, that bamboo shoots, those cooked mushrooms at first, some insoluble fibers, right? Some magnesium, some vitamin C, any of those types of deficiencies that we know can create some of those dysbiosis from a constipation perspective, working on your pro-metabolic diet, making sure that stomach acid is there, antimicrobials like coconut oil, right? A little bit of oregano, just to make sure that you're in an optimal shape. So for when the hormone comes in, you're going to feel way better. And you're going to actually enjoy and benefit from it than potentially following some of the side effects that we see sometimes.
Why do we have to boil the mushrooms for so long?
Mm-hmm. So the boiling of the mushrooms is, well, Ray Pete was saying that there's a specific toxin that is actually very cancerogenic, that if you're not boiling for more than 2 hours, you will be ingesting that and actually helping and increasing your risk of including some of this colon cancer, especially if I'm not mistaken. And it is true. Yeah. Button mushrooms and morels. Those are the ones that we usually see this particularly acid inside of it, that it can be cancerogenic if it's eaten on the raw state of things. Other mushrooms I haven't seen any research on. So all the wild mushrooms seems to be a little bit more on the, you can just cook them naturally and there's none of this acid, but the button mushrooms, the cremini and the morels have this tendency
that's like low simmer for 2 hours, right? And then you drain them, strain them, and then you can cook them again, right?
That's what I do, honestly. Yeah. I boil them and then at that point I just try to sear them or crisp them up with some butter or some ghee to give them a little something. But yes, I usually use also the carrot salad most of the time as well, or just wild mushrooms because of that particular acid is not in there. Okay. I'm a proponent of wild mushrooms.
And they don't work the same as the carrots. They're different. What's special about the button mushrooms and those mushrooms?
The button mushrooms themselves are an aromatase inhibitors. So we've actually seen that we've healed breast cancer in research by just giving high doses of a mushroom diet to women with estrogen dominant types of breast cancers. So that is completely different. It just completely inhibits the excess estrogen. From a carrot perspective, we don't have the research. We have Repeat as a research, which is more than enough for us people, right? Where are we to ask for more than this, right? But we do know that carrots in general, they have an antimicrobial property, which is called anti-quorin sensing, which has seen now in research, because unfortunately their own pharmaceuticals are now antibacterial resistant. We can't use some of these pharmaceuticals anymore. People have become resistant to them. So they're now resorting to natural ways of finding new properties to make new pharmaceuticals. And carrots is one of them that has shown a lot of promise from an antimicrobial perspective, which I believe in that case reduces your endotoxin loads, and that endotoxin loads probably is making you have a better hormonal balance because it's not creating some of this chronic inflammation and histamine reactions that will induce estrogen dominance.
And that fiber probably helps feed the estrobilome as well.
Correct. So exactly. That's right.
Oh my goodness. So I didn't know that about aromatase inhibitors, because that still seems to be my thing, is like, I can't do without the little chin hairs. I'm like, I guess it's just me now, but I'm just going to have to increase my mushrooms. Well, I was saying to Constantine, like, if we can find a way to, an aromatase inhibitor that's just like ultra, ultra potent, you know, and not an estrogen blocker or whatever. I mean, women, and I know it's cortisol, right? A cortisol is what's stimulating that ability to aromatize everything into estrogen. And I mean, if we could just, you know, corner the market on that, we'd all be gazillionaires.
Have you tried topical progesterone?
Oh yeah, I have. I have.
Not working. Okay. I thought maybe it could help a little bit with that area. Okay.
You know what's funny though, or not funny, it's quite tragic actually, is I saw a regenerative sports medicine person a while ago, like several years ago, before I learned about the metabolic stuff, never even looked at my thyroid, put me on testosterone.
Oh, wow.
And within a matter of, and I didn't think for one second that it was going to make me gain weight. I've been skinny, skinny my whole life. And within a matter of months, I had gained, I think it was like 25 pounds or something. And my jaw kind of squared out a little bit. And I just started getting these chin hairs. So I got off the testosterone. I started to understand more what was going on. I increased progesterone. I started detoxing all the things, realized that I was aromatizing everything into estrogen, but the chin hairs didn't go. No,
it's
just like, they're like, oh, we like it here. So
we see that often with a birth control pill that is progestin based, that it actually creates an androgenic kind of state where testosterone gets built. And a lot of women will have exactly that, like a really big weight gain, water retention, chin hairs. They're starting to even see, like, they prefer more feminine faces because their testosterone levels are a little bit more on the higher side of things. There is acne more. So yeah, that makes me, that just gives me a little indication that potentially, you know, like that progestin birth control or any type of testosterone for women,
yeah,
it's really not the healthiest thing to go through.
Yeah, you just don't know what your body's going to do with it, right?
Right.
Oh my goodness, this was just so good. I really, really appreciate your time. This was fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure, honestly.
Okay, right. See what I mean? I mean, she really had me. I just had so many questions flying in out from left field as she's talking, and you know, and then she had answers for all of them, and if she didn't have an answer, she had some useful information regarding the question. And I really like her, and I think that I know she's booked out in advance. I think she's a very busy practitioner, but for those of you who have been following me for a long time, you know, I don't often recommend practitioners, and Benedicta, who we just had on this episode before this one, was fantastic, and I do recommend her as well. But I think because Benedicta's a woman, Andra's a woman, you know, not to say that my other guests are not keen on helping women, they are, but I resonate with these two women, and I just think that Andra is fantastic. And so she does have some social media links that are in the show notes, but she is wellness.by.andra, A-N-D-R-A, on Instagram. And on that Instagram page, you can find her, all her her links to the different things that she recommends. And let me tell you right now, her wellnessbyandra.com. So that's her website, wellnessbyandra.com. She's also really awesome on Twitter. And what I love about her is she's a lot like the repeat people. Like almost all the repeat people are like this. They follow up everything they say with data, science, citations, references, resources, articles, PubMeds, all of it. And that's what I love about these recent guests that I've had, you know, is that they're all about the science. And we love that. So I am so happy that I had her on. I would like to have her back. But if you want to reach out to her, you can do that in the show notes. And don't forget about the Dutch test that was mentioned. I have been doing it now for probably 5 years, offering the Dutch test. And I mean, it's tremendous. When you have a good practitioner like myself, and Andra, and people who can really read into these tests and understand, uncover all of the different layers, right, of what the test is showing you. It's not just a basic blood level number that you're looking at. You know, you're looking at what it means in reference to your liver function, in reference to your adrenal function, in reference to your gut health. It's such a comprehensive test that is not perfect, and it isn't everything, but it's a lot. It tells us so much. And so I urge people to save up for it because it's expensive. You know, you don't want to just buy the test because you can. You can just go onto the Dutch website and just buy the test. You want to make sure you have a practitioner that is going to be able to interpret it really well. Because you also don't want to get ripped off and go and hire a practitioner that's charging $1,800 or, you know, that's blowing it out the box to, you know, I mean, we all deserve to make money for our time, but I think there's a reasonable way to get this test from some practitioners, myself included, making it affordable so that you can get some insight to what's going on and then get like a blood lab through your health insurance company. And then you've got two really good comprehensive labs to work from. And that can tell you so much. In fact, I have even been telling people, and I've been doing this myself, which is saving like literally like a little piggy bank, saving so that I can test twice a year. And that is going to keep us on our toes with what's going on, you know, with our bodies. And then when you're ready for that big session with someone like Andra, who's going to comb through every nook and cranny of your life, including the whole thyroid concept, thyroid function. And, because that's not my wheelhouse. I can tell you if you have a sluggish thyroid or you have like subclinical levels of thyroid function. If you know they're just like subtle irregularities that aren't going to get picked up in blood labs, I can certainly find that. But it's not my wheelhouse to be able to help you balance that. I can give you ideas. My area of expertise, which is crucial, is gut health. And through gut health, I help you bring balance to hormones. But thyroid can be tricky, and you're going to want to see somebody who's very, very good at that. And sometimes that is not a conventional medical doctor, oftentimes. Anyway, I've talked enough. So make sure you use the coupon code for the Dutch, which is ED25, not like erectile dysfunction. It's ED as in estrogen dominance 25. Thanks, y'all. I know.